Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the final presidential debate that is widely seen as game over for Donald Trump, who most of the punditry and many Republicans feel crossed the line in not promising to adhere to the tradition of the loser conceding elections, a cornerstone of democracy which Trump twice refused to agree to last night, then again today, stating that he will only accept the results if he wins. Jeff Hancock, a professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, who researches how people use deception with technology and whose TED Talk on deception has been seen over a million times, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Trump's BS, Why His Supporters Don't Care That He's Lying, and assess whether the outrage expressed by the elites over Trump's threats against democracy will in any way influence his followers who don't trust the media and have given up on politics as usual. Then we will speak with John Judas, an editor-at-large for Talking Points Memo. He joins us to discuss his latest book, The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics, and look into why the traditional political parties in Europe, the duopolies of socialists and conservatives, as well as America's duopoly of the Democratic and Republican parties, are fraying and in some cases splitting apart. We'll examine the surge of populism on the right and left and the long-running and highly consequential readjustment underway as the status quo fails, pitting the people against the establishment. Then finally, we will examine the Syria tragedy from the perspective of the innocent lives devastated by this war, which are chronicled in a new book by Janine DiGiovanni, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. The Middle East editor of Newsweek, Janine DiGiovanni, is the winner of the 2016 Courage in Journalism Award and has covered wars in Bosnia, Chechnya, and Sierra Leone, and joins us to discuss her efforts to get us to understand what it is like for ordinary people to be trapped inside a war, and her hope that we can overcome our lack of compassion for the Syrian refugees, which is reflected in fear-mongering going on in our political debate. And joining us now is Jeff Hancock, who's a professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, where he works to understand psychological and interpersonal processes in social media. Well known for his research on how people use deception with technology, from sending texts and emails to detecting fake online reviews, his TED Talk on deception has been seen over 1 million times, and he has an article at CNN, Trump's BS, Why His Supporters Don't Care That He's Lying. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Hancock.
Thanks, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And of course, I use the polite word BS.
Yes.
Because
otherwise, my mother prefers that as well.
Yeah, well, so does the FCC. Otherwise, they'll fine us. So last night, I mean, there was obviously a lot of BS. And I'd like to talk to you about the distinction between lying and BS and how Trump is able to navigate between that distinction. Mm-hmm. But just to touch on last night, my sense has always been that the more you see of Donald Trump, the less there is. And that's why these debates have been helpful, because he has to be there for 90 minutes and expose largely what he doesn't know. And he seemed to have to resort to a bunch of stale talking points. And in general, I just watched, as I did in the last debate, this man sort of wilt and almost become a joke. And yet, he's got massive following. And at one moment during the debate, there was a huge cheer that broke out, which the moderator had to suppress. So am I in an alternative universe here?
Well, I think you're in a universe in which facts matter and the truth matters. One of the reasons I think that over time in a debate, Donald Trump tends to produce more and more false statements is one of the reasons for why BS is produced. So Harry Frankfurt, in his, you know, treatment on BS, he's a philosopher and wanted to distinguish BS from lying, asked, you know, why do people produce BS? And the main reason, he says, is that whenever somebody is required to speak about things that are outside of their, you know, grasp of knowledge. And I think in this case, Donald Trump has been very upfront about not being a politician. He doesn't do a lot of debate prep, and I think the more he has to speak on these, you know, very difficult, very complicated topics, the more he has to start to BS. And so it fits the BS kind of model perfectly.
But what I take, though, from your TED Talk and from your article at CNN, Jeff Hancock, is that when Trump, for example, says he's going to build a wall and cross the border, southern border, and make America great again, that's completely unfeasible. Everybody said that. Nobody takes it seriously. But it's the broader message that his followers are keying into, not the details of whether a wall or not, whether building a wall is feasible. What they're keying into, that Trump's going to stop the brown people from coming over the border.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's often what a BS session is sort of about. It's about the story and the feelings and the emotions that the people that are engaging in the BS are interested in. So it's not about the actual facts of the feasibility of the wall or that Mexico will pay for the wall. Instead, it's this very important, very deeply held, very emotionally resonant message about being strong on illegal immigration. And it's very clear that his followers feel extremely strongly about this. And in a way, that's what matters when he talks about the wall and not, say, the way other people analyze it in terms of its lack of feasibility. It's about the message here.
So one of the things that I find infuriating about the punditry is that there's this obligation, because of the binary nature of our press, that everything is equal and opposite. And so much of the punditry was sort of trying to tell us last night how well he did early in the debate and how he scored points on abortion and stuff like that. Did you detect any moments where, again, I guess the caveat is, you know, being in the world of reason and rationality may disqualify me, but I'm just curious to get your response.
Sure. Well, I mean, the one thing about Donald Trump that he does extremely well is he's a very gifted communicator, and he speaks in extremely direct, concrete sort of terms, and he is highly charismatic, right? He's got, you know, really great gesturing. He's got a great way of connecting with an audience, and that, I think, is part of what leads to his strength. So in the beginning of the debate, it was really much more about, oh, he has this calm demeanor and the you know, kind of lack of attacking that was sort of highlighted as a strong debate for him. And I don't think we should underestimate the degree to which, you know, how somebody comes across. Those sort of nonverbal aspects are important. They really are, in terms of how people make decisions about trust or not. And these are very old. I mean, we go way back in time, and you can see that people trust different people based on their facial characteristics or based on the color of their skin. So it's a very powerful phenomenon, that sort of intuitive trust.
But just in terms of what you were just talking about then, Jeff, in terms of the optics of last night, if you would have sort of turned the volume off and just looked at the two faces on the split screen for 90 minutes, I think at the end of the day you would have seen basically on the left-hand side an angry, scowling man, and on the right-hand side a smiling woman. That's what I took away. I mean, notwithstanding what you just said, most of the time, his face was taut and angry, and I think almost all the time, Hillary Clinton was calm and breezy and smiling. Did you detect that?
I think that's right, and there's been a few people that have watched the debates purposely with the volume turned off, and in this case, I think that's exactly right. Most people would say the first 30 minutes or so, they both looked, and if you turn the volume on, sounded like regular presidential candidates, and as it progressed, Donald Trump started to look more and more angry and was less able to hold back that scowl and the displays of contempt he has for Hillary Clinton. So, yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Well, it came out, didn't it, when he said she's a nasty woman or something along those lines.
Yes. And, you know, the thing that seems to really get him are the personal taunts about, you know, his, you know, competence, capability, or intelligence. For many other things, he's actually a lot more difficult to rattle. And so I think that's part of the BS argument is he isn't really that concerned with the truth for most things. He uses, you know, makes up facts and states things that are, you know, definitively inaccurate to fit that message. But there does seem to be his weakness, which is anything said around his own personal kind of competence. And that's where we started to see much more of the scowling and the anger.
So the consensus is, and this goes across most of the punditry, and quite a number of Republicans have come out against Trump's refusal to acknowledge and buy into the democratic tradition, the tradition in our democracy of concession. The loser always concedes, and there's always a peaceful transfer of power, which distinguishes democracies from dictatorships. And he was given a couple of opportunities to buy into this tradition and convention, and he refused to do so. And even his own people were apologizing for it or trying to spin it in all kinds of extraordinarily mentally gymnastic ways. But at the end of the day, today, what happens? Trump says, yeah, I'll accept the results of the elections if I win.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, it's getting where he's not being very presidential in his, arguments and statements and the way he's speaking in public. And it fits, I think, this BS idea, which is that there's a reality out there that he's trying to refer to and create. And part of it is that he's rigged. I thought, frankly, that one of the best parts that Clinton did was pointing out how often he said things are rigged across a wide range of things, from, you know, other Republicans rigging things against him to, you know, the Emmys. So the BS argument basically is that it's not really lying, because he's just interested in getting this one message across and has nothing to do with the truth. It's kind of independent of the truth. And this is a really good example of BS, and perhaps also the most dangerous. There appears to be very little evidence of voter fraud, and that when it does occur, it's very minor, that the U.S. has developed a really stable and highly decentralized voting process that's very difficult to rig. And so this is a really excellent but unfortunately very dangerous example of BS. It's perhaps BS at its worst.
But do you think that there's another factor at play here? Because we're still not entirely convinced, at least I'm not, that this will be a landslide for Hillary Clinton, and that somehow Trump's support is being exaggerated. It's hard to quantify, but in general, this is an anti-status quo election year, and you can go back to the primaries. The enormous popularity of Bernie Sanders indicated this sort of popular surge on the left, and Trump's indicates a popular surge on the right. But at its heart, what this is all about is a broad and wholesale rejection of politics by much of the population, who are just sick of being lied to, and they're sick of politicians, and they're sick of their rhetoric, and they're sick of their empty promises. And so this is really, and as good as Hillary Clinton was, and skillful as she was, and as well-informed and incredibly facile in being able to talk about complicated policy issues, she's still a politician, and the other guy is not a politician. So how much do you factor that in?
I think it's another piece of the puzzle for why fact-checkers, you know, identify Donald Trump's claims as false, you know, over 50, 55% of the time, and Clinton's much lower, you know, in the 15%, 20% range. Yet they're equally considered trustworthy and honest. And part of it is this decline in trust in American institutions. And the government is a big part of that decline. It's also, you know, trust in church, trust in journalism, trust in Congress and politics is at a 10-year low. And because Hillary Clinton comes from that institution, I think that actually does work very strongly against her. And I'm not sure that all of that has been incorporated into the polling, that sort of strong distrust right now in institutions. So I'm not a pollster, and I don't feel I have much expertise on that to talk about, but it's certainly the case that trust in these sorts of institutions is really low right now.
And do you think that it's possible to rationally explain or distance yourself from the gridlock and dysfunction of government? In other words, I think Hillary Clinton and the Democrats could make a case that the Republicans are largely responsible for gridlock. That seems to be their policy. After all, on day one, when Obama got elected, the Republicans met to figure out a way to destroy his presidency. And Mitch McConnell said our number one focus is to make him a one-term president. And now we have reports that Donald Trump, Stephen Bannon, his closest aide now, and Roger Ailes are thinking about putting together a post-election competition, if you will, for Fox News, an alt-right version of Fox News. That primary job would be throughout the next 4 years to just absolutely attack Hillary Clinton relentlessly and try to cripple her presidency. So that seems to be what's happened to our politics. They seem to have descended into a sort of gladiatorial take-no-prisoners blood sport as opposed to the tradition of bipartisanship, if indeed it ever was a tradition.
Well, my colleague Matt Gentzko here at Stanford, an economist, looked through the language of partisanship over the last, I think it was over 100 years. And it is certainly the case that we see the lowest sort of levels of bipartisanship language now, and it's been a major dip over the last 2 decades. All those things that you mentioned are a big concern. I don't think that any one party has a monopoly on sort of increasing partisanship, but it's certainly the case that the sort of radio and alternative sort of media have increased the vitriol, I think, of our political discourse. And it's really unfortunate. As somebody that studies social media often gets blamed for, you know, all these interpersonal arguments, you know, the crazy uncle or the really, you know, crazy niece, say, post something on your Facebook page that enrages everybody else. And the unfortunate part is that we need to continue talking to each other about politics and recognizing that we're not, just because we may support one candidate or the other, not necessarily a jerk, but that, you know, we have some differences and it's okay to have these differences. But I worry that the types of programs that you mentioned, like an alt-right thing, but probably also alt-left, you know, a radio that espouses hate towards other groups of Americans, those are really, I think, the deep problem here. And I don't have any answers, but I, other than the fact that it's important that we keep talking to each other and not categorizing each other into jerks because, you know, they support one candidate or another. We have so much more in common. So difficult, very difficult and worrisome.
Well, but when you say we need to communicate, you know, more often than not, you see a group of people sitting in a restaurant and they're not talking. They're all looking down at their laps and tapping away on their cell phones. And there is this extraordinary phenomenon now in social media where never before in history has so much been said by so many about so little. And it's there's a clear advantage that I see that Donald Trump has in his facility with social media, his use of social media. And I'm not entirely convinced that there isn't a kind of new culture that's grown up around social media where people live vicariously through the lives of others like the Kardashians, and that Trump is a part of that new phenomenon, what you could call a Kardashian culture.
I think you're absolutely right that Trump has displayed incredible facility with this new medium, you know, Twitter in particular. And it's certainly the case that people are using their mobile phones in lots of previously tech-free zones like the dinner table at a restaurant or other places. And there's no question on all of that. But I think I'd push back a little bit because, you know, typically what those people are doing on their phones is communicating with somebody else. And while that can be really bad, if I'm sitting face-to-face with you, if I was with you right now, Ian, I'd be really, you know, I'd want to talk to you and be engaged with you. And I, you know, if you started using your phone, I might say something to you. But there's also a lot of advantages. We wouldn't be able to be speaking right now if we weren't able to use phones. So I think technology is a little bit more like fire. It can be, it can burn down our house, absolutely, but it can also keep us warm and keep us alive. So in terms of the Kardashians, you're absolutely right. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't understand that culture. But we've been fascinated by celebrity for a long time. And you can go back to the courts of the French and English monarchs. And that's what people wanted to talk about. That's who they wanted to see. They would show up for giant parades and wait for hours in the rain to see the king or queen. So it's not necessarily social media's fault, but it is certainly the case that it's changing the way that we engage in this sort of celebrity behavior. And I think Donald Trump is a big part of that, no question.
Well, just in closing then, Jeff Hancock, back to the central thesis of your article at CNN, Trump's BS, why his supporters don't care that he's lying. Given the reaction that's pretty universal to last night's debate, where everybody's basically saying it's game over for him, for Trump. You know, he crossed the line. He's violating a tradition in American democracy by not agreeing to concede. Do you think, given that's what the conventional wisdom is, now let's talk about his supporters. Do they see this in the way that they see the difference between lying and BS, that, you know, this is just another part of the kind of mainstream media, or the lamestream media, as Sarah Palin calls it, venting against our guy, and it's basically, you know, totally irrelevant to them because they don't trust the media in the first place, and they do believe that the game is rigged against him, and he's been telling them that.
I think that's the key insight, is that they have lost faith and lost trust in a lot of these institutions. And when that happens, it's extremely difficult to rebuild trust. And it's very easy to see how violations of that trust take place once you've already lost that trust. So, yes, although I think this is BS, I don't think there's a lot of evidence of rigging. I believe his followers and supporters strongly believe that the election is being rigged against him and that the media is a big part of that. And I'm worried and very upset because in the past we've had candidates that have tried to temper those, you know, sort of instinctual and very scary sort of feelings, like people legitimately feel like they're not being heard and that things are being stolen from them. We've had leaders in the past that have tried to work against that. I'm thinking of John McCain as an example, or Mitt Romney. In this case, Trump has made it very clear he will do the opposite. He will really stoke those fears, and that's what he's talking about in pretty much every speech. So, I am worried and about that aspect, and I don't know how best to counteract it, given that it's BS. I think BS is in many ways more dangerous than lying, because with lying, you can just counter with facts. You can use the truth. And with BS and the amount of fear that it's stoking, I'm not sure. Facts don't work against BS.
Well, Jeff Hancock, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you, too. And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Hancock. He's a professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, where he works to understand psychological and interpersonal processes in social media, well known for his research on how people use deception with technology, from sending texts and emails to detecting fake online reviews. His TED Talk on deception has been seen over 1 million times, and he has an article at CNN, Trump's BS, Why His Supporters Don't Care That He's Lying. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the populist explosion, how the Great Recession transformed American and European politics.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Paranoia strikes deep.
into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Judas, who is an editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo, an active member of SDS and the Left of the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. He's the author of Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origin of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, and his latest book just out is The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Judas.
Glad to be there.
And it's pretty extraordinary to sort of watch this great tectonic shift underway in politics, not just here in the United States, but also in Europe, where it's pretty clear that this is going to be a long-running and highly consequential readjustment as the status quo fails and the people are pitted against the establishment. We've seen the duopolies of socialists and conservatives in Europe starting to fray and break up. We haven't seen the duopoly here in America of the Democratic and Republican parties. But given the strains within the Republican parties, John Judas, do you see the Republicans cracking up, particularly if Trump goes down in flames?
I'm not sure. I have two scenarios in the back of my mind. One is that Trump gets creamed. I'm in Colorado now, and I don't see any Clinton ads, which is exceptional because this is supposed to be a swing state. I mean, they're campaigning in Utah and Arizona now. So I assume that he's going to get slaughtered. So the question is, what next? One thing I think is that his defeat, like Goldwater's in 64, will allow the Republican establishment, the Ryan, McConnell, the Chamber of Commerce, to assume control again of the party and of the nominating process. And that would happen in the states as well. And Hillary Clinton has trouble at public politics. She's going to face, even if the Democrats take the Senate, she's going to face a gridlock. And you might see just a revival of the Republicans, a new Republican wave in 2018. I think that's very, very possible. And we'd be back to the kind of status quo before Trump. The second thing is that Trump could really damage the Republican Party. He could create a split, say a permanent lobby against Ryan, trying to get rid of him. He could strengthen what had been the Tea Party forces, and in that case, the Democrats might have a way to keep the White House for 8 years, and also to whittle away at the state control that the Republicans have had over the last since at least 2010. So, you know, one or the other, but I don't know which. My guess is it's going to be number one.
Well, there's also talk now that Donald Trump and Stephen Bannon and Roger Ailes will form a new alt-right TV network that will be challenge Fox News for the right-wing viewers and may even peel off Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. And the purpose of which is to be basically a permanent thorn in Hillary Clinton's side, to be, you know, a 24/7 hate speech media juggernaut that just rips her administration apart and tries to cripple her from day one. Is that a possible scenario? I mean,
I'll tell you what I think has happened to Trump and. But again, I might be wrong. I know a lot of people say, well, at this point, he's not really running for president. He's got this new network in mind and a kind of revival of the Ku Klux Klan in new garb, a new kind of faction in American politics. I think that Trump, playing himself, succeeded in the Republican primary, and he thought he could use the same script in the in the general election. He thought he could sort of, he's a lot of what Trump says, a lot of his crazy, outrageous things are things that guys have thought privately but have never said publicly for 50 or 60 years. I mean, I'm of the age to understand that. And he got away with it in the Republican primary, and it made him more popular. And his base was all, tended to be older, white, just exactly those people that his violation of political correctness would appeal to. But in the general election, it's just destroyed him. And I think he's completely at sea and doesn't know what he's doing now. Maybe the Trump TV, but again, he has to think about this huge business and his children and what it's going to do to them. And is Ivanka going to become a TV network producer? So I don't know. I'm less sure that he has something clear in mind. I think the guy from Breitbart might have something clear in mind, but I don't know what's going to happen to Trump after November when he loses.
So let's get into the sort of definitions here of or the differences between left-wing populism and right-wing populism. Left-wing populists, as you've written, champion the people against an elite or an establishment, whereas right-wing populists champion the people against an elite that they accuse is favoring a third group, whether it be immigrants or African-Americans or Muslims, etc. So anything more that you can add to that?
Well, yeah, the only thing I'd say is that with the what I call right-wing populists, you do get scapegoating, but you also actually get economic positions that might otherwise be defined as left-wing. And, you know, that's I was amazed when I first heard Trump in August of 2015 in New Hampshire, and he was complaining about runaway shops, the NAFTA, corporations moving their headquarters overseas to avoid taxes. So you do get the same dimension as the Sanders kind of populism, but you also get the scapegoating.
But the other part of the, in terms of definitions, is there a working definition for who the people are and who the establishment is?
Absolutely not. It's populism isn't a substantive ideology. It's not there. Who the people are and who the elite are change. For instance, the Tea Party was railing against the liberal establishment when it was found in 2019, 2010, the Tea Party groups. By 2012, they hated the Republicans just as much. And in fact, if you do interviews, the main people they really hated were Boehner and McConnell, whom they accused of treason. And I'm talking about the local groups, not of the lobbies in Washington, like Americans for Prosperity. So, you know, we long more poor people. Trump, silent majority. Sanders, not, you know, middle class. It varies, who the establishment is and who the people are. What's the same is that you have this conflict between a group, the people, and an establishment, and you have the idea that the leaders of the establishment won't accede to certain demands that are essential right now for the people. Medicare for all, free education, college education, what have you, building a wall across the from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean. So, again, it's this kind of logic, the idea that there's a people and there's an elite, and the elite won't grant these demands. That's what really defines populism.
So in terms of right-wing populism in Europe and in the United States, surely there is a detectable element of racism. There's a racist xenophobia in Europe, particularly in Hungary, against the immigrants that were flooding in from the Middle East. That's been very, very clearly documented. And you've got Orban, who's said some extraordinarily racist things about maintaining European cultural purity, etc. And he's even got a more right-wing group, the Jobbik, to his right. And Le Pen in France has made racist comments. And also Trump here in the United States has. So is that a common thread?
That's why I would say that there's a scapegoating element. you know, being against illegal immigration is not necessarily racist, and it really is. It's, what is it you call it? In America, it's nativist anyway. It's not racist. But a lot of people think that there should be certain restrictions on immigration in order to protect low-wage workers and unskilled workers. But it's the stigmatizing. It's saying that they're rapists. You know, it's the Trump. It's the kind of line you get from Trump, or the kind of thing you get from Congressman King in Iowa, where it's not a question of which really is at the heart of it. Companies wanting cheap labor and attacking the companies for that, but it's a matter of the illegal immigrants themselves being somehow, you know, rapists, murderers, drug dealers, and what have you. So that, yes, that's the nativist element within right wing populism. And in Europe, there's groups like the Finns that are more centrist and want a Canadian system of immigration. It's not that racist scapegoating element is not integral to all kinds of populism.
But in terms of trying to sort of distinguish populism, say, on the left from progressivism, progressives want to fix the system, which is pretty much the way that Hillary Clinton ran her campaign against in the primaries against Bernie Sanders, where he, the populist, wanted to change the system. Is that a correct analysis?
Yeah. I mean, I would add something to it. Historically, you know, you get progressivism in America, early 20th century, and then Roosevelt talks about liberalism. But it's British liberalism, that's the term. It's not the old-fashioned liberalism. And the idea of it is reconciling class interests. It's not being for labor against the corporations. It's not socialist in the sense of working class versus capitalist class. It is pluralistic. It's the idea that there are all these competing interests and that you're going to accommodate them, but accommodate them in the way that's fair to the to workers, the middle class, blacks, Hispanics, whatever. That's really the central idea, and that's different from populism, which sees a kind of irreconcilable conflict between the people and the establishment.
But Teddy Roosevelt was the kind of definition of progressivism, but he also did have a kind of populist movement behind him, did he not? Because, I mean, and of course, McKinley, who died...
No, he was... let me interrupt you. He was not a popular... I mean, he was very much opposed to the American populace. And the Republicans of 1896 ran against Bryan, who did incorporate a lot of American populism. Theodore Roosevelt, now we're not even Franklin... Yeah. Was really the person who defined progressivism as finding a way not to be for either capital or labor, but to find a solution that would be a transcend that kind of conflict. And he saw the populists as divisive.
Well, but coming out of the Williams Jennings Bryan McKinley election, I mean, he was the fortunate benefactor of an assassination, Teddy Roosevelt. They put him on the ticket to balance the left-wing populism of Williams Jennings Bryan. I mean, that was a period when you had in America a religious left, did you not? A kind of union of working-class rural folks, farmers, and urban people that were basically, was that when we had a populist left that it's only recently been rediscovered by Bernie Sanders?
There have been populist movements in the United States. It really starts 1880s with the Farmers Alliance and their idea that they had to build themselves an alliance with the Knights of Labor. So you had farmers and workers, and they were the groups that formed the People's Party in 1892 and ran for president. And that's when the word populist itself was coined. And there have been a succession of populists. Candidates and campaigners in the United States. Huey Long in the 1930s. Fred Harris in the 1970s. George Wallace again from the right rather than the left. Ross Perot, very important. A lot of the positive rather than the destructive negative side of Trump echoes Perot, Pat Buchanan, and then, you know, Sanders on the left. So it's been a tradition in America since 1890s. And the kind of populism that we had in America really only starts to appear in Europe in the 1970s or 1980s. Before that, you really don't have the same kind of movements or candidates.
Well, of course, you had in the 1850s, you had a combination of right-wing populism and xenophobia and anti-intellectualism with the Know-Nothing movement. And maybe some of that is reflected in Donald Trump's constituency. I thank you for joining us here today, John Judas. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with John Judas, who is an editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo, an active member of the SDS and the left of the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. He's the author of Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origin of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. And his latest book just out is The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the Syrian tragedy from the perspective of the innocent lives of people trapped inside this war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Janine DiGiovanni, who's a Middle East editor of Newsweek and contributing editor of Vanity Fair. She's the winner of the 2016 Courage in Journalism Award. And since the beginning of the Arab Spring, DiGiovanni has mainly been focused on the Middle East, a region she has been working in for 2 decades. She travels extensively to Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt to do field work and research, and her concentration has been on the war in Syria, which she writes about in her new book, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. And she also has a documentary about her investigative work inside Syria called 7 Days in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Janine Giovanni.
Good morning. Thank you.
And you've been a long-time reporter covering wars in Bosnia, Chechnya, Sierra Leone, and lately in Syria, where your book really explores what life is like or how innocent lives are devastated by war, examining the lives of everyday citizens, a man in search of his family, a female activist taken by the police, and rape victims, etc. And the book does give us an understanding of what it's like to be inside a war. I must say the there was very little compassion shown for the innocent victims of the Syrian war, the Syrian people, in the debate last night, particularly from Donald Trump. So how do you explain this disconnect between, I guess that's what you're trying to do, aren't you? You're trying to tell the world about what's happening.
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure I could put myself in the shoes of Donald Trump or indeed even of people that aren't paying attention to what's going on, because basically it's my world and it's my life. And I find it hard that people do not have compassion for people that are in such desperate situations. The Syrian war will be going on for 6 years next winter. 6 years is a terribly, terribly long time to be engulfed in a conflict. It's basically the entire span of a child's primary education. So when you think about it, people that have been living under siege, people that have been living with no future, people especially in eastern Aleppo right now who are being ruthlessly bombed, slaughtered, starved, deprived of the most basic human rights, including the ability for their children to go to school, any kind of freedom of movement. The UN has imposed a humanitarian pause as of last night, which means basically evacuation of the severely wounded. But many people believe that that is really just a chance for the Russians, who are, of course, aiding President Bashar Assad, to clear out the city and give them an empty city. In fact, the Russians have gone as far as to put on their Twitter site, the U.S., the embassy in the U.S., this is what Grozny looks like after we cleared it up. And basically, Grozny was the Chechen capital that they ruthlessly bombed in 2000, the early 2000s, and in the wars in the 90s, and then rebuilt into what they wanted. So these are very, very desperate and grim times indeed in Syria.
Well, it does feel like, since you've covered the broader region, that this is back to the future, because the intervention in Libya was predicated upon the notion that Gaddafi was going to slaughter the citizens the besieged city, Benghazi, that he was attacking, and that became the reason for the humanitarian intervention. Which, of course, later Putin was furious about with his Prime Minister Medvedev. But nevertheless, it feels like, given that the what happened in Libya, bringing down Gaddafi, inspired in many ways the Syrian people to take to the streets, and they were subsequently slaughtered by the regime. But it feels like we're back to the same position now, where a city is being besieged, the civilians are being slaughtered. But this time, the world is not going to intervene. The Russians got the jump on the U.S., and they appear to be incredibly callous and indifferent to the fact that they're committing war crimes in front of a apparently a somewhat indifferent world.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I don't like to compare situations with Libya or Iraq. I mean, every war is very different. And, of course, the Libyan conflict is extremely different than Syria. Libya is a very different country from Syria. What happened in Libya in the aftermath is, you know, very different than aiding Syria, which could be about humanitarian intervention and saving the lives of civilians. The means for going to the limited airstrikes in Syria that in Libya were, I think, was a very different thing. So I try hard not to make comparisons. If I do, of anything, I do with Bosnia, with the situation that happened in Bosnia, because like Syria, it was very much a war against civilians. It was targeting women, children, non-combatants, and that's very much what is happening in Syria now. I mean, getting back to your original question of how people are not compassionate enough, I live in Europe. I live in France. And so Europe is in a very different situation because, of course, there's 4 million refugees, Syrian refugees, that have been displaced from their homes, 9 million inside. They have to go somewhere. And they're coming mainly to Europe. Germany has been extraordinary, taking more than 1 million people in. France, Britain, less so. The Scandinavian countries are always excellent at helping. But I find it shocking that America, which is meant to be a country of many different diverse people, and I myself am the daughter of an Italian immigrant whose father came here during the time of fascism in Italy, and I grew up as an American, but an Italian, a very proud Italian-American, why we are turning our backs on this, because it does affect us. A failed state in the Levant, which is what Syria is becoming, is of no good to anyone because it signals the rise of terrorism, the rise of more violent groups than ISIS, than al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda faction within Syria. So I think the whole attitude of, I'm just going to close my eyes and not look at it. This is an election year, of course. America's got its own problems. But this is something we can't ignore. President Obama, who I have huge respect for, has ignored it for far too long. And what happened then is that we have basically ISIS growing and growing. The push for Mosul, which is going on right now, may in fact free Iraq's second city, which is Mosul. But we're going to have continued problems with extremist groups. And I think a lot of this was because we allowed Syria to become a political vacuum.
So in terms of the weaponization of refugees, which is a charge that the former head of NATO made against Vladimir Putin, it's worth noting that the major exodus of refugees into Europe took place shortly after the Russians arrived in Syria. And it seems logical to me that if Assad, the Iranians, and Russia are able to force everybody out of Aleppo, won't they create another massive Sunni exodus, the logical place may well be another outflow of refugees into Europe?
Yes, absolutely. The Russian involvement is not really a surprise, because there was a vacuum of the Americans or basically the West, the international community, not going in to help. President Putin does want a foothold in the Middle East. Historically, they did have one, and then they were basically superseded by American and Britain and France and other countries that had a further, more lucrative involvement in the Middle East. So Putin seized his opportunity, and he's using it as a way of saying, this is our fight against terrorism. And let's not forget, to be fair to the Russians, they have had their share of some really brutal terrorism inside Russia, because they border places like Dagestan and Chechnya, you know, places that do produce quite a bit of homegrown terrorism. So he does have a small point in that, but I seriously do not think this is President Putin's intention of aiding or doing anything to help people. It's really a way of getting an economic foothold in the Middle East, and don't forget that the Russians have an important base in Tartus inside Syria. So President Bashar al-Assad has help from the Russians and also the Iranians. The Iranians are a big ally there, in the same way that, again, in Iraq, going back to the fall of Mosul in 2014, Iran was there when the U.S. did not come to the aid of the Iraqis, who were overrun by ISIS in Mosul. It was the Iranians. So I think the lesson to be learned here is, if you want to be a superpower, you've got to in some way step up. And the U.S. has neglected the Middle East, has neglected the whole ISIS issue, has neglected what's happened in Syria, and as a result, it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's not going to go away.
Well, presumably, the Obama is a gun shy because of the disaster that Bush and Cheney created with their what seems like an unnecessary intervention that has had such devastating ramifications. But still, you spent a whole day at the UN addressing the situation in Syria. Russia obviously has veto power. There's also this other aspect, surely, that Putin has contempt for democracy. He's taken Russia's democracy away from the Russian people. He's interfering with our elections. It probably is a way to signal to his own people, look, you may not have democracy, but look at those hypocritical Americans, how screwed up their election is. And clearly, Assad is his kind of guy, as is apparently Donald Trump his kind of guy. So this is also, I think, about, at the end of the day, I think the outrage that you express in your book, Janine DiGiovanni, is about humanity and this assault on humanity that's going on before our eyes. You know, it happened in Bosnia, and it's happening again.
Yeah, so I think this is really what I'm trying to get across in the book, which you can get on Amazon very easily, and also the documentary that I've made called 7 Days in Syria, which again is available on iTunes or on Amazon or Google Play. And I think watching that gives a good window, and reading the book is a very good window into what's happening in Syria.
And what do you think can be done in terms of I mean, the first lady, I suppose is the term to use, of Syria was recently on Russian television, and it was pretty surreal to have her make this rosy picture of what her and her the family that she married into are doing. I mean, essentially, this is their plantation, and they'll kill everybody to hold on to what they consider their divine right to rule this country, which the family's been doing for decades. But just the other day, Assad, in reference to the iconic picture of the young boy in shock with dust and blood all over his face sitting alone in an ambulance that galvanized a lot of attention around the world, Assad says it's a fake. I mean, how do you deal with this man apart from, I guess, what should have been done, which is removing him? And by the way, I recall Hillary Clinton and a lot of people in the Obama administration predicted his demise, which certainly hasn't happened.
Yes. Well, I think that it's complicated, and I think I haven't had the chance to sit down with President Assad. I would very much like to. I'd very much welcome that. I was working on the Damascus side in the very beginning of the war and have not been able to get visas to go back. I think that it's important that, you know, we can't, first of all, participate in regime change, because look at what happened in Iraq. I think that, you know, I was living in Iraq in the time of Saddam and in the aftermath, and I think that Saddam Hussein was a monster, but it was up to the Iraqi people to decide that and to choose a new leader, not George Bush, for reasons that we now know was purely for his own benefit and for oil and for his rich neocon friends from Texas. I think the disaster that came from Iraq has given an excuse to many people around the world to say, well, look what America's intentions are. I think it's very important to help the Syrian people build up institutions, human rights, rule of law, freedom of expression. These are things that we did not do in Libya after the bombing, and that's one of the reasons why it failed. Libya was a country that had, you know, 40 years of dictatorship, and with a dictatorship, you don't quite have a civil society that functions. So I think more than anything, they need our support, particularly in those areas, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of press. They don't know what it's like to have journalists that can speak like this freely on the radio or on TV, the human rights, and policing. So all of these things in the post-war scenario that Syria will be, and I have no idea how it will look, I don't have a crystal ball, will have to be developed, and that's where our help is going to be needed.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Janine DiGiovanni.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Janine DiGiovanni, who's a Middle East editor of Newsweek and contributing editor of Vanity Fair. She's the winner of the 2016 Courage in Journalism Award. And since the beginning of the Arab Spring, DiGiovanni has mainly been focused on the Middle East, a region she has been working in for two decades. And she travels extensively to Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, and Syria to do field work and research. And her concentration has been on the war in Syria, which she writes about in her new book, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. And there's also a documentary about her investigative work inside Syria called 7 Days in Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.